Welcome to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. Our lives, our voices. I'm Eric Jansen. This week, Golden States of Grace. While depictions of mainstream religion are widely visible, rarely seen are the sacred worlds of those marginalized by society, the outcasts, the fallen, the others. Ironically, according to this week's guest, these disenfranchised and disinherited are the people for whom religions were first formed. Rick Namias is a photographer, writer, and visual storyteller whose social issue-themed media projects have been shown across North America, Europe, and Asia. His latest book and traveling exhibit, Golden States of Grace, Prayers of the Disinherited, gives image and voice to groups and people who, because of the world, society, or their own actions, have been silenced and now worship to find refuge and community. Through photographs, oral histories, music, and text, Golden States of Grace documents 11 marginalized faith communities from San Diego to Sonoma County, including San Francisco's Transcendence Gospel Choir, West Hollywood's Kashi Ashram for people with HIV and AIDS, Bet Teshuva, a Culver City Jewish congregation of recovering addicts, San Quentin prison inmates practicing Zen Buddhism, and transgender sex workers in San Francisco's Tenderloin who worship Santissima Muerte. The Golden States of Grace exhibit is on display through March 18th at Santa Clara University's De Cese Museum. Rick Namias, who lives in Los Angeles, spoke with me when he visited San Francisco soon after the book was published. He said he wanted to do a multimedia project about religion after his success with The Migrant Project, Contemporary California Farmworkers, which documented the human cost of feeding the country.
I found that there was a way in which I looked at marginalized communities that helped bridge people's understanding of the us and them equation. I think part of that is that I am got one foot firmly planted in the mainstream world, being a white male, and also being a gay man, have a foot in the marginalized world. And it's something that's fascinated me as far as being able to understand these people's stories in a very human, dignified, and inspirational way. And that kind of helped frame the project.
So tell us about some of the specific communities that you looked at. There's a total of 11 in the book. How did you go about choosing them?
If there's one thing that I specialize in, it's kind of a three-dimensional diversity. I didn't want just Jews, Catholics, Mormons, so forth. I wanted people who really could help push the boundaries of the definition of disinherited. So it includes people that are disinherited by birth, people who were born deaf, people who were marginalized by society, such as survivors of genocide, and those with HIV, and then people who, through their own hand, were marginalized, people who are dealing with addiction, and people who are incarcerated. And it was there was no question there was kind of a political an inspiration in that respect for me, because I saw religion being co-opted by a mainstream kind of Bush-era, you know, conservative Christian agenda, where folks on the margins didn't exist, let alone being pushed out. They just, their faces weren't seen. And this was a way to bring out their stories in a way that hopefully might make people look at things a little different.
Tell us about the folks in this book. What is to you like the most, what raises the most eyebrows?
Well, there's no question that probably the sex workers who pray to Santa Muerte raises the most eyebrows. Their photographs are extreme in the sense that they're, you know, transgender sex workers from Guadalajara, and there is a look that they have, and there is a way in which they in which their appearance really you know, is something you would come across on a street corner in the Tenderloin, and you know, unless you were really stopping for business, you'd keep on going, and you'd keep on going fast. But what I find in their story, as well as several of the others, was the unexpected. Yes, these are sex workers. Yes, these are folks who are kind of living on the edge and they're undocumented immigrants, but they're also, in many cases, really articulate, thoughtful, sensitive people. And the stories of one of them in particular, who Yahaira, who actually, you know, has a very concerted effort of sending home her wages, portions of her wages to her family so her brothers and sisters can go to school, is something I just never thought of from a prostitute. For me, I learned a great deal. I mean, even, you know, I started this project at a halfway house for recovering Jewish addicts. many of us live by, you know, the stereotype of the nice Jewish boy and girl. Well, these folks have proved that you can still be a nice Jewish boy and girl, but you can live completely outside the definitions of, you know, the accountant, the attorney, whatever. Many of these folks come from really incredible stories of addiction and some incarceration, and yet they have found a way to move through their lives in a way that I feel breaks stereotype yet engages people on a deeper level.
Let's talk a little bit more about the Santa or Santissima Muerte group here in San Francisco in the Tenderloin. What specifically led you to them? How did you find them?
They came on my radar through the advisement of Lois Lorenzen from USF. She has done a lot of work around religion, immigration, women's issues, and the environment. And when she saw that I was looking at religion on the margins, she thought about the Santa Muerte group and thought about transcendence. And she connected me with her researcher who had actually gone out and met these women who are bilingual. And having a woman make that introduction is important because, again, as a white man with a camera bag, I'm one of the most threatening things there is. And we would meet them.
Especially with an illegal trade involved.
Two illegal trades. You're undocumented and you're a sex worker. So, you know, two strikes against you, if you want to look at it that way. But they, I don't want to say they were wholly welcoming. There was a lot of kind of dodging me and giving us fake phone numbers, and it was a lot of hunting and pecking, and it took several days to kind of find a cohesive number of them that I felt would really help fill out a different perspectives within the Santa Muerte observance. And we would meet them often out on the street right as they were going to work, and the introduction would be made. We'd talk about the project, or I should say Susana, who was my translator, did, and made a plan for the next day to come see them. And in most cases, they showed up. Finding them again when I went back to do the audio interviews for this, and now since the book has come out, has proven really difficult. They're a pretty transient group. Phone numbers have changed. Emails have changed. They were mostly living in SROs, you know, up on Polk Street. The most interesting story I have was when I came up in 2006, right as this was about to premiere, I was still completing the soundtrack, which travels. It's an ambient track of spoken word, prayer, and music, which plays in the background in the galleries where the exhibition is, kind of helping create a sacred space, if you will. Well, I had interviews with virtually everybody, but I was up here for the opening of the Migrant Project, which was at the downtown San Francisco Library, and Susana was able to help connect me with Crystal again. So Crystal...
And Crystal is one of the women... Workers. Right.
Yeah, so Crystal was... living on Howard Street at the time, totally different place from where it was. She told Susana, yeah, I remember Rick. Give him my number and we'll connect. So I'm literally in my, you know, nice suit and tie giving a talk on migrants. I knew I had this little window to catch her. I call her as I'm going back to my hotel. Hi, it's Rick. Remember we talked? I wanted to come over and do a quick interview. Great, baby. Come on over. Great. We'll see you in a few minutes. Here's my address. So I come right over. Really quickly with the same, you know, recorder that I spoke of. And I get up to her room and she greets me in a full on body stocking with like 15 watt red light bulbs and like pulls me into the room and throws me on the bed. And I'm like, whoa, wait a minute, Crystal. It's Rick. Don't you remember me? Clearly she had gotten her signals crossed and she was expecting a John like within the next 5 minutes. So she says, no, I can't talk. And she only had about 6 or 8 sentences of English. And it was just so bizarre because, you know, this is a man, so she had the power of a man as she pushed me on the bed, and I had to kind of recompose myself, and I've just never been in a situation like that. And like I said, you know, thanks, but no, I'm here to do an interview. She was so focused on the John that was coming that she picked me up, pushed me out the door, and that was the last we've heard of from Crystal. You know, and I tripped over a junkie or two as I went back to my hotel and didn't get any sex worker interviews for the soundtrack, but we have several prayers from them in the book.
In the traveling exhibit, there is audio that weaves behind in the background. It's a combination of sound and prayer and music.
I call it kind of a mosaic of spoken word, prayer, and music, and they're either music from the groups themselves, like Beit Teshuvah has its own band, and they actually take traditional Hebrew stuff and put a reggae spin on it, actually some really good stuff. Additionally, there is listening stations for folks who want to go a little deeper. About 25 of the images have a number icon and you put in, you know, 15 and hit pound, and you hear, you know, Ma Jaya from the Kashi Ashram speak about her, you know, moment of enlightenment.
You are in my temple of death right now, where I actually had death drip all over me. And I can't ever get past those years of me sitting here welcoming death. If anybody in the world can prove that one cannot get AIDS by kissing, hugging, just laying in the same bed and holding someone till they die, which happened in my bedroom over there, could be me. I had saliva over me. I've had sweat over me. On my breast, I was holding them close with KS over me. So that's number one fallacy. And you may say, but why are you saying this now, Ma? Because these little prejudices, these little fears still exist. Saw them 20 years ago, but I still see the shuddering and the fear of don't touch me if you have AIDS. And I'm a very, very angry woman, only I know what to do with it after 25 years. I know how to teach. I know how to say, like you just heard me, do something.
You're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Eric Jansen. We just heard Guru Ma Jaya of the Kashi Ashram in West Hollywood. It's one of 11 marginalized communities of faith profiled in documentary photographer Rick Namias's book and traveling multimedia exhibit, Golden States of Grace, Prayers of the Disinherited. The exhibit is on display through March 18th at Santa Clara University's De Sese Museum.
So Transcendence Gospel Choir, why were they included in this project and how did you get led to them?
They were the first group that Lois Lorenzen helped me connect with. And there was something to me metaphoric about them.
Describe them for us.
They are the world's first transgender gospel choir. And I think even now they are probably still the only transgender gospel choir. And what was really unique about them was several things. They have a sense of humor about themselves. They know that their voices are, you know, they are not AME church. But they damn well sing the hell out of anything that you give them. And though there's a rotating number of people in the choir at any time, when I was with them, I think it was about 18 or 20, kind of what holds them together and what I thought was really an important kind of metaphor for this as a community was that they use the gospel that they sing as a way to adjust to their voices shifting. They find a common voice, literally and figuratively. They are some men coming into being women and women coming into being men, but they all meet in this middle ground. And it's a constant shift and struggle to keep that middle ground. But they do it with the commitment of a spiritual journey and something that they share as a community. And I thought it was a powerful and very important community to include. They have a very strong identity. I think they're clearly, you know, they've traveled the United States doing concerts. They've put out a few CDs at this point. Their journeys as transgenders, I felt, represented a lot. Each one of them had their own journey through transitioning. I mean, the word transitioning, really, trans, just comes in so many forms. One thing that I really became very clear to me when I started documenting them and started doing the interviews was what was really going to be neat about this project was you might be a Jewish addict, but you could also be a transgender addict who was Christian, and you could be someone who was incarcerated and dealing with a marginalization of another kind. There was so much crossover here because I did run into transgenders who were HIV positive, so they related to the Kashi Ashram later on, or transgenders who were dealing with substance abuse, so they related to the addicts in Los Angeles. The way, the fluidity of this group was really something amazing, and the way they embraced that. You know, as a gay man, I live in a box. in my own way, but there's something that brought me closer to the trans community where I really came to respect their ability to live in a gray zone. You know, it's not black or white, but they just live their lives in this kind of spiritual and physical kind of fluidity, which goes from male to female and sometimes back again. And they're all perfectly fine with it, but they aim to be perfectly fine with it. And that is an incredibly courageous thing to do.
I worked on a documentary a few years ago called Why We Sing that included the Transcendence Gospel Choir as one of the four choruses that we featured. And I was struck by almost every single person in the Transcendence Gospel Choir talked about how the reason they do spiritual music now and why the choir is so important to them is they were kicked out of their churches. They were totally rejected by their churches. They were and felt religion was had nothing for them. And I'm curious to know if the other groups that you that are included here, to what extent that's true for them too. What other these marginalized groups were felt not included by mainstream religion or by their religions that makes them on the fringes of their religions?
That was a big thing. I'd say almost all of them, not all of them. Actually, an interesting exception are the deaf Mormons. Now, the deaf Mormons have a place within the bigger Mormon church where they are both supported financially and creatively and spiritually. They actually have their own sanctuary. That was a pretty beautiful thing to see. That, you know, again, being deaf is a marginalization, which is a lot different than being, a convicted murderer. But the fact that the Mormons, as many issues as I have with Mormons, in light of Prop 8 and other political things, is to see their embrace of their own folk who have been marginalized and who are struggling with being out of the mainstream. I can't say that I saw that in any other faith. But what you said is exactly right, that many of these people have memories of a deep or a warm or an important religious experience as children, which was then snatched away from them in their teen years or as adults, for whatever reason, as they drifted out of mainstream. And their communities now, as they're represented in this book, were places where they reclaimed that, empowered them, gave them a sense of community, gave them a sense of sanctuary, gave them a sense of a safe place to be, and a place where they could find others of a similar type. And that, to me, was kind of the most beautiful thing, because you can, again, spin the wheel and look at the eight different faiths, and it didn't matter. That experience, that safety zone is something that many of us who may go to a mainstream church or synagogue don't experience. We're in with 400, 500, 800 people, and we lose that personal connection. Well, these folks haven't. They've really kept that tight-knit thing going.
Showing your photographs of the transgender sex workers here in San Francisco helped you get an entree into the Immaculate Heart community in Santa Barbara, which I guess most people from the outside would look at the book and say, well, they're the most kind of normal group of the 11.
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about?
Well, it was interesting. I kind of do a lot of show and tell with groups before I actually go to meet them. I want to make sure that they're right for the project and I'm right for them. I had a meeting with the Immaculate Heart board at their high school in Los Angeles, and it was an early Saturday morning, and I was sitting there kind of flipping through the portfolio I brought before I went into the meeting, and I was very tentative. I was saying, you know, they would be group five, and the first group was addicts, next one prisoners, transgenders, and sex workers. I'm like, this is never going to happen. So I was about to pull out the photographs of the sex workers, at least to soften it a little bit. And something in my gut said no, because if nothing else, you will be authentic. And if they reject you, it will be because you were at least honest about this, because you can't show up in a gallery a year or two from now with a finished project and have people in there that, you know, these people would have not accepted. So I went in, I gave my little pitch. They were very polite, showed me the door, and I figured that was it. It wasn't going to happen. And then 2 days later, their director, Marie Egan, called and said, we'd like you to be at our retreat in 3 weeks and to be part of this project. So I came, I did my work, and as I was packing up to leave, one of the elder nuns kind of shuffled up to me and said, it was really nice having you here, Rick. I hope you got what you needed and the stuff is usable. And I said, yeah, it really was. She goes, I don't know if anyone told you, but why we did this project. I said, no. And she said, we did it because of the photographs of the sex workers. And I said, really? And she said, yeah, our order, the Immaculate Heart Order, began in Spain a few hundred years ago, and the first people that we worked with were street workers. And it was your sensitivity to their story and their plight which made us feel comfortable and trusting of you. And it just was, again, one of those moments which happened repeatedly in this process where I felt there was something, again, bigger and beyond me kind of driving the project forward and broke another stereotype. Were these, you know, scared, angry, emotionally shut down nuns? No, not at all. They were incredibly open, giving, and inquisitive, and an incredibly intelligent group of people that really wanted to reach beyond their comfort zone.
So tell us a little bit about more about how this group started. The Immaculate Heart was sort of a, they were women who were kicked out of the church, Catholic Church,
right,
back in the, tell us the history there.
The Immaculate Heart community, which has a retreat center in Santa Barbara, but they're actually based in Los Angeles, they, and I think it was 1971, it was the early 70s, they were dealing with the Archdiocese of Los Angeles as nuns in the order. They were, you know, they were being fed and clothed and housed by the Catholic Church. But they found, as a collective group, that it was a patriarchy that was not very interested in issues dealing or affecting women. They were not interested in dealing with social justice issues in the way that these women wanted to. And so they, as a group, collectively kind of resigned. They left the church. And it wasn't just leaving the church. They left behind pensions. They left behind cars. They left behind things that they had saved and worked for decades as nuns, Catholic nuns, to go out on their own with a great deal of uncertainty. So to me, there was a huge amount of courage in that split.
Namias was led to a Buddhist group of San Quentin inmates by Reverend Paul Chafee, director of San Francisco's Interfaith Center at the Presidio.
And there was something metaphorically really unique to me about folks who were, you know, destined to be in a cell, and the monk in his cell. I thought they were not so polar opposite, but actually there was a lot of crossover there in a metaphoric way. And so I wanted to explore that. I thought visually it could be a pretty cool thing. And I learned about Buddha Dharma Sangha, which is the group that's led by Lee DeBarros from the Zen Center of San Francisco up at San Quentin. And that was a difficult group in the sense that it took close to, I think, over a year of maneuvering with the warden and getting permissions and getting in and all that stuff. But I ultimately made three visits to the prison. And Vincent DeRusso's story is in the book as well. He wrote a beautiful oral history about his journey from being a convicted, you know, a convicted robber.
I started to read that on the way down here. He just went into a liquor store and took the guy out and shot him. And then after that had this revelation about the meaning of life.
You know, and what's really important is I really was very careful. I didn't really go for people. It was like, look, I found God. I'm a better person. Let me out of prison. That's not the stories in here, and it's not what I'm putting out as the experience I had with this. These are people who are still, they understand what they've done. I mean, there's some pretty notorious criminals that I worked with in this book, and they weren't like, oh, let me sing praises to the Lord, and again, you know, maybe I'll get out earlier if someone sees this book. It was their own reckoning with the concept of redemption, their own reckoning with how did they possibly live for life behind bars and find spirituality and a sense of peace with what they did, the restitution to their victims. I found that really powerful stuff. Again, the time a prisoner has to reflect and read and study and question is a lot more than you or I have in our daily lives, so it probably shouldn't be surprising.
You have a lot of stories come up, what if, but you stop the stories and you come back to your breath. And so I get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, and I stop the story real early in the morning, you know what I mean? And then at night, you have to sit again and stop the story again.
Many of these guys had learned about meditation as a way to kind of make it through this transition of becoming, you know, 25 years to life. So how do you face that, and how do you face yourself in light of that sentence?
When you sit, a lot of stuff comes up for you. You replay all the stories of your past. What I wish I could have, wish I didn't, you know, what could I have done? But it also allows you a chance to connect the dots in your life, to see that this was dependent on that. And so it wasn't just an isolated thing. I was on this road when I started using drugs and using alcohol. Things in my past started accumulating, There were signs that I didn't recognize. So that's the past. There's not much I can do about the past. But from the past, you can change the future. And the only place you can change the future is in the present. So I have had a rare opportunity here at San Quentin.
The fact that some of these men and women took the time and have taken the time to dig deep into their, you know, souls to really ask these questions, I think is fascinating stuff for me.
Namaya says he wanted the book, Golden States of Grace, to be very different from the traveling exhibition, much more than just a catalog of the museum exhibit. The book has nearly twice as many photos, about 100, as well as essays by academics and historians, and also personal stories by the participants, and 36 prayers written by the participants. He wanted the book to be a contemporary visual prayer book.
So I went back to each of the groups and asked for prayers. I asked for people to write prayers, whether they were in prison or they were even living in a different religious community. And I got dozens and dozens of them back. It was a really difficult thing to choose which images to pair with which prayers. But one thing I was very clear of, like I am in the exhibition, is this is not the Mormons over here and the Muslims over there and the Jews over there. There's really not a photograph, except for maybe one or two instances, that is accompanied by a prayer from the same group. I really want the communities and the different faiths side by side to comment on each other. And in a sense, it kind of takes you on a journey through the different themes of sacred spaces, of redemption, of future generations, things like that. And the prayers, to me, were an integral part of that.
So when you look through the book, there are photographs next to prayers that aren't necessarily even by the same people who are in the photographs right next to them.
Yeah, like you'll have a photograph of Women of Wisdom, which is the spiritual interfaith group from Chino Prison. It's all women. It's all folks who are, well, they're using a range of different faiths. On one side of that is a Native American prayer. On the other side is a prayer from the Muslims, which relate to what's going on in that photograph. I mean, there's definitely a context to it. And there is a progression, if you will, from prayer to photograph to prayer. And it's meant to have flow. And that was that took months and months. It was really quite a house of cards to try to get the balance right.
In the book, Namaya says that religion should be for the people on the edge, the disinherited, the disenfranchised.
If you go back to, you know, the early Christian doctrines, I mean, and I have to preface this, I am not a religious scholar. I studied religious studies for the ceremonial and ritual and visual side of it. I was really kind of pulled in by that. I know nothing about liturgy or really deep theology. But one thing I do know is that religion was really created for the misfits. It was created for the people whom, and Rabbi Mark Borovitz says it really beautifully, about how religion was created for those on the margins.
Well, the disinherited, the addicts, the fallen, however you want to put it, they're what the Jewish tradition was built for. 36 times at least in the Torah it says, take care of the widow, the poor, the orphan, and the stranger. For you were strangers in the land of Egypt.
You've been listening to Out in the Bay. My guest, Rick Namias's book and traveling exhibition is called Golden States of Grace, Prayers of the Disinherited. The touring exhibition is on display in Santa Clara University's Desassay Museum through March 18th. You can learn more about the exhibit and the book online at goldenstatesofgrace.com or just see the Golden States of Grace program listing on the homepage of our website, outinthebay.com. I'd like to thank some listeners who really came through for us recently. Jack Busby, huge thanks for your generous longtime support. Also, Jim Gatto and his employer Parnassus Investments, which matched Jim's donation 2-1. Please remember, folks, that many companies match their employees' donations to nonprofit organizations, including Out in the Bay. So don't be shy about asking your HR department to double or even triple your gift. That's right, make your boss help pay for Queer Radio. It's easy, secure, and tax-deductible at our website, outinthebay.com. You can also get free podcasts at Out in the Bay and sign up for Stitcher, the app that lets you download radio programs to your smartphones and other mobile devices. That's right, Stitcher. Weekly podcasts and Stitcher free on our website, outinthebay.com. Out in the Bay is independently produced by me and Marilyn Pittman. We thank KALW for studio use and airtime. We'd love to hear from you. Please email us. Eric at Out in the Bay and Marilyn at OutInTheBay.com. I'm Eric Jansen. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.